When the news makes us angry or fearful, our first instinct is to share what we've just heard, not to upset the people around us, but to commiserate, maybe protect one another from the bad things that happen. As gut-wrenching as they are, the stories of people like Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and so many other victims of racial injustice are bound to go viral. But with a little bit of intentional effort, so can the stories of people working for a better world. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The point isn't to make terrible events easier to accept, and it's not that good news can somehow balance tragedy. But spreading the word about positive steps toward justice can inspire others, or at the very least, to help those working for good realize that progress and hope can survive even in the wake of catastrophic failures of human compassion. Ruha Benjamin is professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, where she is the founding director of the Ida B. Wells Just Data Lab. Her book is called Viral Justice: How We Grow the World We Want. Ruha, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You start this book by sharing a little of your own story, and specifically the influence of your grandmother in your worldview. And you write that within her community, she was always on call, even after she retired from working. Tell us about her.
You know, I think of her as one of these people. Many, we have many in our families and our communities who really is focused on keeping the social fabric strong and tight, connecting people, making sure that people have what they need, whether they're relatives or not. And so she's a connector. And I think about this time where we have, you know, a public health crisis of isolation and people feeling alienated and alone, that this ability to keep people connected, to keep communities tight, is actually a vital resource that we have to cultivate. And so although it seems like, you know, something that we could sort of think about, we could do without, it's actually good for our health and our well-being to really feel connected to those around us, our neighbors, our communities. And she was one of those people who did that.
Her response when she was the one to pick you up after you got in trouble following this kickball altercation at school, it was surprising to you, at least at the time. Now it makes a little more sense.
Yeah, so you know, I want not the last time that I would be suspended from school, but she was the one to pick me up. My parents were at work, and rather than sort of just double down on what the school did, which was obviously punish me as they're, you know, trained to do, she embraced me and she gave me my favorite snacks and hugged me and loved me and made me feel like, you know, cared for. And the lesson for me was that I was better than what my behavior was showing at the time. And she was reminding me of who I really was and what care looks like. And so rather than, again, use punishment to reinforce that rule, her way was to model what real care and responsibility and love look like. And in that way, kind of shined a light on what I should do in the future. And so, you know, it was my first lesson in kind of watering the world we want. Whatever we want more of, we should actually water and cultivate it rather than just focus on what we don't want. And she was my first teacher in that respect.
So you write about being deeply hurt as a middle schooler when you realized your teacher was leaving you out of a lot of discussions in the classroom, perhaps because you were the only Black student in the class. How do schools end up reproducing and then reinforcing existing racial hierarchies?
Right. So this was about sixth grade, and it was the first week of my honors math class. I was an eager beaver, really excited, raising my hand, waving it at times. And over again, my teacher ignored me and didn't call on me until my parents intervened. And so one of the things that I'm wrestling with in this particular experience and in the book overall is the fact that it wasn't the school in the abstract that was doing this, it was an individual. So we have to think about our role as individuals in perpetuating the status quo. And so it's what we would call spirit murder, where we, you know, really crush the spirits of young people in terms of, you know, embracing their potential. And the question for us is, if we don't want spirit murder, if we don't want to engage in this, we have to name the alternative. And so what does spirit nurture look like? It's an active invitation rather than just, you know, trying to play neutral, look the other way. we have to think about what are the actions that are harmful, but then what can we do right now, yesterday, about this in the way that we engage with young people, engage with each other, rather than waiting for top-down change. And so that's really the invitation, is to say, yes, we need changes in our laws and policies. We need to think about how we fund schools to make sure there's more equity, but we can do something as individuals right away in terms of how we approach learning, teaching, and really nurturing the potential of young people.
How are some schools replacing zero tolerance policies with what are called restorative practices?
Right. And so it's about relationship building at the core. It's about thinking about restoring or storing to begin with. Sometimes there's no relationship to begin with, to think about that social fabric. And so rather than use punishment as our go-to way of trying to keep people in line and to create order and discipline, let's think about what are the conditions that young people are learning and what are the stressors that they're bringing into the classroom, into the school. How can we acknowledge their full humanity and then build relationships based on that? So a number of schools are working on the idea that the relationship between young people, between teachers and administrators, are the ground zero to try to create really flourishing environments. And so when someone does, you know, harm someone else, the idea is if we want the behavior to change, punishment often doesn't, it's a short-term fix. It doesn't teach us the lessons we need to learn about how to be more caring and more respectful and accountable to one another. And so there are things like restorative justice circles where people can express how they were affected and talk about what would you know, addressing that actually look like from the point of view of those who are harmed and moving forward from that. It's about calling people in rather than pushing them out of our schools through expulsion, through suspension, because that often just reinforces the conditions of feeling alienated and feeling like they are not cared for, that then perpetuates the kinds of behaviors that we're supposedly trying to stop.
This was so interesting. You note that what some people, including teachers, might identify as certain students wanting to sit there and do nothing could very well be a rational strategy for survival, even if it's one that we hope to change.
Right. If you think about the fact that, you know, for many people, many young, you know, students and young people, almost everything they do is scrutinized. They can't make a move without someone, you know, saying that they're misbehaving or they're not doing it right or they're not speaking in the right way or they're not dressed in the right way. Some schools even police the hair of young people when it comes to braids or afros or dreads. And so if your very being is being punished, and there's actual rules on the books that say you are wrong, the way that you walk into the school is wrong, then if that is the level of scrutiny that you're undergoing, doesn't it make sense to try to freeze in place, to try not to do anything that would then further mark you? And so we have to understand the wider context in which this is happening, in which some, for some, their dress, their demeanor, their style is already policed before they can even say or do anything. And so standing still and not doing anything is a rational response to that level of surveillance.
So what's a way that schools can change their tack toward these students?
One of the groups in one of my classes this semester, we were doing a class called Methods of World Building, and it was interesting. One of the groups actually tackled this very question. And when it came to rules, they created this intervention. It was a kind of speculative proposal. I don't know if it exists in the world or not. But the idea is to create guidelines, principles, rules in collaboration with students, to think about schools as laboratories of democratic decision making, as incubators for the future. And so that would mean that if we want more citizen participation, if we want more democracy among adults, we have to start that kind of civic participation early on. And so what better way than to actually collaborate with students and learners in creating the rules and the guidelines and the forms of accountability in any school? So this group of my students actually created this whole proposal, this consultation model, a way of creating the rules in a way that's aesthetically sort of pleasing and artful in the buildings and the walls. But the key thing is that it's not a top-down enforcement. It's a collaborative model of decision-making to think about what would make our school a place where people felt like they could bring their whole selves to the table. And I think that starts with not just the end point, which is what are the rules, what are the guidelines, but the process. How do we get to that point? And I think when we start to actually listen to young people, I think they have a lot more wisdom and insight on this process than we might give them credit for.
You note in the book, Ruha, that American schools, broadly speaking, are more segregated today than they were in the late 1960s, which is dispiriting enough. But even on campuses that are the exception to that, where there are seemingly diverse student populations, tracking can contribute to this phenomenon where students are showing up to the same building, but they are not really interacting.
There are schools within schools, you know, where under the roof of one building, there are so many different ways of resegregating and distinguishing people based on class, race, but using these seemingly neutral categories of class levels and tracks to do that resegregating. And so part of what we have to pay attention to is not just the explicit forms of segregation that we think we've outlawed, but know that it's racism is mercurial. It can change and morph. And we find other more inventive ways to then continue to make these distinctions. And school tracking is certainly one of them. And it's not surprising that there often we can find racial class, categories sort of mapped onto these newfangled tracks. And so we need to think historically about what led us to this point where we think this is a useful model. Who does it actually serve to continue to use these kinds of distinctions? Whose potential does it crush in the process and who's being nurtured? And so again, there is a process underway that I discuss in the book, a detracking movement of schools experimenting with getting rid of these ways of classifying students, and they're seeing wonderful results as a result of this.
You're an educator. Have you thought about ways that schools and universities can assess student performance without perpetuating what we now sort of understand to be the myth of meritocracy in this country?
Absolutely. And so again, like the detracking, there's an ungrading movement underway in which we're really assessing in a much more holistic way, rather than just, you know, using these stale categories of A to F and these different metrics, to think about what is a more holistic way. What do we want students to get out of these classes? What do we want them to be able to, how do we want them to be able to use it in the future? And again, a lot of this is collaborative, to start the semester or the year off in consultation with students and their parents about what they hope to get out of this, what our hopes and aspirations are for them, and then using that as a more holistic, qualitative way of engaging in assessment, rather than what is not just kind of the stale metrics, but increasingly the use of technology to proctor, monitor, and surveil young people, their eye tracking, their movement as they're taking tests. And so the other extreme is a really high-tech form of surveillance that completely, intervenes and robs us of these relationships and these collaborations that we could be building on.
And perhaps, Ruha, I should correct myself. Other people are doing viral justice, but you have found this term. Maybe give us a sense of what viral justice encompasses.
Absolutely. It's not a new theory or a new phenomenon. It's just a lens to look at the everyday, seemingly small ways in which people are working to engender more justice and equity and love in the world. And so, you know, I'm trained as a sociologist, which means I have tended to look at more macro processes, more structural, institutional level phenomenon. And so this book and this discussion is an attempt for me to bring myself back down to ground and say, within these institutions, within these structures, there are individuals who make things run. There are individual decisions, actions, habits of thought that actually are the fuel of all of these things that look on the surface to be big and macro level phenomenon. And so I want to look at not only the way that individuals perpetuate harm and injustice, but all of the ways that people are working to counteract those and create something different in the world. And so in some ways, it's a love letter to those who continue to get their hands dirty in whatever corner of the world that they're working on, whether education, healthcare, and neighborhoods, you know, all over the place, to think about what we can learn from their work.
This book focuses on spreading progress toward justice, spreading joy, but you don't ever shy away from injustice because you can't. You note that your father's early death from the flu at the age of 63 was surely the result of more than just a virus that he picked up.
Right. And so we know now we have the language of social determinants of health, the way that our experiences, our air, our water, our environment gets under our skin, into our bloodstream, affects our stress and our overall health. And so this is a way that our insides and our outsides are connected, right? Nothing just happens purely because of genetics or something under the skin. And so if we know that to be the case, it's what public health scholar Arlene Geronimus calls a weathering effect, that we are weathered by our environment the same way we might notice a building that's weathered over time. So that means that what we do in terms of our environment actually matters to our individual health. And so if it matters for the worse, why can't it also engender more healthful outcomes, more healing? And so, you know, thinking about the weathering effect, how can we create a climate that actually benefits us, that we don't have such high levels of premature death? And this really came to a head, obviously, over the last few years, but I experienced it with my own father in terms of the stressors that he experienced as a matter of the, you know, his job experience, the housing crisis, and a whole host of other factors that I think really weathered him over time and led to his greater vulnerability to the H1N1 virus, which ultimately he died from.
A huge weathering effect on Black parents is worrying that their Black children, sons in particular, are not safe in this country.
I remember, you know, the first few months of COVID, my sons were teenagers at that time, and they were back home from school, the oldest one, and had come back from college his freshman year. And they wanted to get out of the house, like they had cabin fever, and they wanted to go for a jog through the neighborhood. And, you know, as they would leave the house, I would kind of get this really tight feeling in my chest, because this is also the time where we were learning about what happened to Ahmaud Arbery going for a jog and getting stalked by two men in his neighborhood and ultimately killed, and a whole host of other examples. And so the paradox here of my son's doing this healthful behavior, right, going for a jog that should be conducive to their health and well-being, and yet placing them at greater risk from other kinds of harms. And so as a parent, it's always trying to balance that idea of trying to, you know, shield them from those harms, but not suffocating them. And that's always the challenge, is how do we protect them without also stifling them? And how do we also safeguard our own well-being in terms of the stress that that causes? And so this is something I write about as a larger phenomenon, not just unique to myself, but all Black parents that I know, or parents of Black children more broadly, that have to grapple with this paradox.
You, of course, recognize the importance of science as a tool for understanding human health, but you have been frustrated that studies of the racial component of health disparities very often just result in more studies rather than any real action. When you write, "The facts alone will not save us," what else do we need to pursue?
You know, again, going back to my training, I love, you know, investing in education and in science and data. But at a certain point, I feel like we're engaging in the datafication of injustice. By that, I mean the demand for more and more information and support for things we already know. Like, we know poverty, it's hard to learn when you're poor, when you haven't eaten when you are, you know, living under conditions that are stressful, that it's not rocket science. We know that this relationship exists, and yet there's more and more, you know, research poured into, let's figure out the exact mechanisms that make it so that if you are poor, you know, your SAT scores are going to be lower, or your, you know, graduation rates are not going to be as high. And at a certain point, and I think we've reached that point long ago, that demand for more data becomes a placeholder from acting on what we already know. And so it's in some ways disingenuous that, you know, this demand for science means, okay, let's take what we know and actually translate it into action, into policy, into institutional change, into everyday change of our behaviors. And so, again, the facts alone will not save us raises the question, what will save us? Investing in strengthening the social fabric and making sure that everyone has what they need to thrive. And I think a huge part of that is really recognizing that another person's well-being is connected to mine. You know, this idea that, you know, for some people to thrive, other people have to suffer. I think we have to get rid of that zero-sum approach and really understand that strengthening the social fabric, making sure everyone has what they need, it helps everyone. Our fates in that way are really connected. And I think when we wrap our heads around that sense of connection, we'll be more motivated to invest in the things that we all need.
So many people might hear this term viral justice and think this sounds like a really good idea, but then put it in the same category as something like charity. And you point out here, building community well-being benefits everybody, including those doing the work. This is not something that you do for others.
Exactly. It's not charity work, and that's not charity work, but that presumes some people have and other people don't. And so we're going to, you know, do something that's to benefit the underserved. But what we know is that inequality makes everyone sick, even those who are the purported beneficiaries of an unjust system. That is, in places where the gap between the haves and the have-nots is greater, the so-called haves in those states, in those countries, actually are faring far worse than those who live in more equitable places. And so we have to ask ourselves, what's happening, you know, where inequality is actually not good for anyone, even those who are supposedly privileged by those systems. And we can look, for example, at maternal health. We know that the Black maternal health crisis is something that has been getting more attention, that percentage of Black babies that die at a higher rate and Black birthing people that die at a higher rate, it far outpaces those of other racial groups. But if you treat white women as a country on their own, their health outcomes are much worse than other industrialized countries. That is to say, and even some developing countries, that is, even white women, their health outcomes are not very good, especially considering how much we spend on healthcare in this country in terms of high-tech approaches. And so this is just one example of many where if we invested in particular approaches and policies that affected the least, that is the have-nots, those who are currently suffering most in an inequitable environment, it's actually going to benefit everyone. And so this is a call for us to think about, you know, our linked fate and the fact that, you know, equity actually is something that we would all gain from.
And when it comes to these different health outcomes for mothers and babies by race, you urge us to be aware that the culprit is not race itself. It is racism.
You know, if I was walking through a field that had landmines in it and one blew up and I was harmed, I wouldn't say, you know, I was harmed because I have arms and legs. I would say it's because those mines have been buried there to hurt me. In the same way, when we frame adverse health outcomes, we say, oh, this bad outcome, you know, is because of her race or her gender. But those are properties of the individual. When we should turn the lens and look at what's actually creating the harm, it's not because she is Black or because she is female. It's because of a combination of racism, sexism, classism, et cetera. And so in our naming and in our diagnosis of what's harming us, we have to look at what's creating the problem and not individualize it. not say, oh, it's because I have arms and legs that I got blown up. It's because someone planted those mines there that's making it hard to navigate this world. And so we have to really pay attention to how we are diagnosing and framing the problems so that we can accurately intervene in them.
What sort of role are doulas playing, particularly in communities of color?
I think birth workers generally, Black birth workers in particular, are playing a crucial role, though we're not investing, acknowledging, and respecting the work that they're doing. They're really standing by, caring for, and accompanying birthing people in this really crucial stage of their life, there where our vulnerability is heightened to all of the exposures around us, the adverse weathering events around us. And so in many ways, doulas and birth workers more broadly serve as a kind of buffer from that environment, shielding people, helping advocate for them all the way through pregnancies, but also in that the crucial labor period, really holding space for their pain. That we have studies that show that just the experience of being having your hands held, someone looking in your eyes, someone breathing with you can physically lower the pain that you're experiencing. And so we have measures of that. And so if we think about the doula effect, how can we learn from that in the way that we accompany people, not just in the healthcare context, maybe in education, maybe in the workplace, the more that people are experiencing, you know, various kinds of trauma and harm, we need people who are trained to accompany and advocate for one another.
So we really have to fix these bad outcomes for Black mothers and babies in particular. But you do worry that looking at Black motherhood only through the lens of crisis misses out on some things. Will you talk about that?
Absolutely. And so, you know, that's what we would call a deficit framing of a problem, where we only look at what's lacking, what the problem is, rather than looking at what are the assets, what are the insights that people who have had to navigate these harmful environments bring to the table. And so I would encourage those who are doing research or who are in education or other contexts to be able to acknowledge the problem, but not to look at the people as the problem. It's what, you know, the late great sociologist Du Bois, he said, you know, the feeling of being a problem person, it really infects so many of our cultural discourse about Black communities in general. And so what if we started instead from what insights, what knowledge do these people and communities have to bring to the table that we can learn from, that can actually frame our approach and the changes we want to make in healthcare or education or other contexts? And so it's that asset framing that I really want to encourage us to do. But to do that, we actually have to work with and in communities, not simply for them, in a kind of charity model or top-down approach.
You share the story here of your younger brother, Jamal, who sort of grew up surrounded by the same weather that you grew up with, but became vulnerable in a very different way. How was he effectively criminally penalized for being ill?
I think it even started before his mental health crises as a teenager, that even though we grew up in the same neighborhood, had the same family, I think his experience of schooling was very different. I think his experience of being over-disciplined in school and walking through the doors and being seen as a problem started very early. And that's why I spend so much time talking about that spirit murder experience, which I think then became one of the triggers to his later crises in life. Whereas some people can afford therapists and afford different therapeutic approaches to mental health, oftentimes the police and policing are the go-to response for vulnerable people and communities, racialized people. And so that was my brother's experience of having a crisis in LA and the police being called and then being jailed in what is essentially a really torturous environment, documented by those who are hired to run it as being a place that actually exacerbates one's mental health crisis. And so this is an example of the response actually reinforcing or making the problem worse. And so there, we know we have other tools, we have other approaches that I think are more humane, more loving, more just in terms of you know, really addressing people who are vulnerable or people who are ill, like my brother.
We're kind of obsessed with crime statistics in this country, but you point out something I had never considered before, which is that crime data essentially never includes violent offenses committed by police or by prison guards.
Absolutely. And so this is one of the, you know, distortions of them when we talk about crime is that it never encompasses all of the forms of harm that are perpetuated. And though, you know, those who create the rules are never included in their own statistics and their own data. And so we can't take it at face value. There are many things that we count as crime that we should, like we talk about the mental health issues, that we should be treating in a more therapeutic way. And then there are many types of harm and crime that are perpetuated that never see the light of day, that are never counted, especially those who that are perpetuated by officers, prison guards, etc. And so one area of this has to do with sexual assault. It's the reason why so many people who experience sexual assault don't call the police. One of which is that there's a high rate of sexual assault by the police. So why would you call the very individuals to intervene and try to adjudicate, you know, when you experience that form of harm, when they have also been perpetuators of it? And so that's why we have to completely rethink our approach to these issues, because right now, you know, what we have is a situation where it's poisoned at the root.
Ruha, on the bad side of viral, you point out the destructive potential of something like the Citizen app, which, as one person described it, provides a kind of gamification of vigilantism. Can you explain what this is for folks who are not familiar?
Absolutely. So like any other app in your app store that you can download, it is a tool that allows everyday people to, you know, report on different crimes that they suspect are happening and to monitor crimes in progress. And to, you know, it was originally called vigilante, which gives you some indication of what was behind it. And eventually the, you know, founders decided, oh, maybe we need to rebrand this after they have some backlash. And so now it's called Citizen. But, you know, in one of a really dramatic case of this happening, the use of this in LA, where they essentially put a bounty on the head of someone suspected of arson, the wrong person was eventually arrested in this citywide manhunt through this app. And so, you know, this is an example of the using digital tools to, you know, amplify the worst tendencies in society, which is that we gang up and then use really distorted metrics in order to, in this case, try to find someone who's committed arson. And so if that's not the solution, what is? What will actually make us feel safer in our neighborhoods, in our communities? Is it just reporting anyone that looks suspicious? For those of us who are routinely on the reported side of things, who are often seen as suspicious in public spaces, that's definitely not the case. And so let's think about, you know, what it would mean to have stronger relationships with our neighbors, to actually have neighborhood associations where it's not about looking out of our window suspiciously down the street at who's coming by through our Ring doorbell, but actually knowing people by name, having potlucks, having block parties, looking out for each other. And so a low-tech analog way of strengthening the social safety net rather than relying on digital tools that anonymize and exacerbate forms of surveillance. Every day, we might call it little brother surveillance instead of big brother surveillance, in which we're always looking over our shoulder. I think that doesn't actually make us safer in the long run.
We've talked a lot in recent years about the problems of racial bias among members of police forces. We haven't talked as much about something you point out here, which is the way that the creation of the 911 system positioned police officers to be agents of white supremacy in the sense that they are called to act whenever a white person is inconvenienced by a black neighbor.
We saw this play out, you know, a few years ago in Central Park, where Amy Cooper was calling 911 to report on Christian Cooper, no relation. And so we saw her weaponize not only 911, but also white femininity, like calling upon her tears and her sense of vulnerability. And so this is a combination of not just 911 in isolation, but in combination with the racial gender dynamics of, you know, who is considered a threat and who is considered vulnerable in our social, you know, context. And so I think it's always important when it comes to the way that technology, whether it's 911 or the Citizen app, are critiqued, to always situate it in the social world in which it's being mobilized, so that we don't just blame the technology. It plays a crucial role, in this case, you know, 911, but it's also the fact that it's routinely weaponized by those, my colleague Jesse Daniels called nice white ladies, in which they, you know, really weaponize their vulnerability, and in this case, could actually lead to real forms of harm and death, even when police are called to the scene.
When you note that viral justice entails redress and reparations, what are some forms that can take?
And so when we think about the context of healthcare, we know that, you know, Black communities, Black bodies have been used to hone many of the techniques, whether in gynecology or in other kind of interventions that we've been experimented upon in order to develop science and innovation. And so if that's the case, we have to think about what it means that the very communities who, you know, were necessary for the development of our modern medicine, don't even have access to basic forms of healthcare, whether they're underinsured or uninsured. And so as one example in the context of healthcare, I think it would mean free healthcare, free access to not just any old healthcare, but quality, you know, culturally attentive healthcare. We don't have many Black doctors in this country, and we know that the racial correspondence between doctor and patient really has a great effect in terms of the outcomes, whether maternal outcomes or otherwise. And so it would mean not only free healthcare for the nationally and for Black communities in particular, but also investing in the training of Black doctors, birth workers, nurses, because that has a direct positive impact on the health and well-being of communities. And so that might mean free tuition for, you know, people who are dedicated to serving those communities. And so I think we can be really creative when we think about what this looks like. It is important to historicize it to say, precisely because these people and communities have been harmed by our government, by our institutions, have been neglected, that calls for a really earnest and creative reinvestment in their well-being and their, whether it's health or education or otherwise.
Is there a way to safeguard those kinds of reparative efforts from white backlash and the white sense that somehow they're not getting some benefit that Black neighbors are getting?
I don't know if it's totally possible, because once people have their minds made up, you know, just the facts alone, again, will not necessarily convince them. But I think part of my approach is to go back to this idea that it's not zero sum, that these kind of investments actually positively can impact everyone. And so if we think about it strictly from a financial level, the amount of waste, money that is wasted on, you know, the kinds of late stage interventions because people haven't had good quality preventative health care, it could mean millions, billions of dollars saved in taxes if we had a more preventative approach where people had early and easy access to health care provision throughout their lives, so that we didn't spend so much on, you know, really emergency late stage care. And so even if people want to think about it strictly from a financial perspective, it really benefits us all if we take a more proactive preventative approach, whether it's in education or healthcare or safety in our neighborhoods, to think about how much is wasted on our carceral system that is actually not making us safer. How much is wasted in terms of, you know, thinking about young people who are pushed out of schools, who then have to resort to illicit activity in order to survive. All of these have a ripple effect. And so when we think about the investment in people's well-being early on, we have to think about this as deeply connected to our own well-being. It actually saves money, but it also creates a much more livable world when we feel connected and we feel that everyone is getting what they need.
You note in the book that, you know, the pandemic at least temporarily changed the script about so-called frontline workers, right? These people whose jobs truly are essential for the functioning of society. Very often, these are people of color in the United States. Why did efforts to build respect and dignity and decent wages for these folks ultimately sputter?
Wow. I can't say definitively without kind of looking to see if there's anyone who's actually tracked this empirically. But my sense is that the more that our approach to the pandemic became a kind of every man for himself approach, where we felt that we could actually insulate ourselves or lock ourselves in our homes or work from home and not have to engage with others or get our groceries delivered and not have to, you know, interact with people in our community, the more atomized this public health crisis became, I think the less we were motivated to care about those who were keeping things running and were actually those who didn't have the luxury to then hunker down. And so I think part of it is a symptom of the fact that we approached what should have actually raised our level of connection and, you know, sense that other people's well-being, you know, impacted ours. And it just made us even more atomized and defensive and, you know, it didn't foster the kind of care that we might have hoped.
How are some cities using participatory budgeting to shape the way programs work for the people who are supposed to benefit from these programs?
This is a great example of the process mattering as much as the endpoint, that, you know, a budget that is actually investing in social goods like work and healthcare and education rather than in policing, for example, that it's not just the endpoint that is a more just budget, but it's the process. It's the fact of listening to what community members actually care about and the different projects that are local that can't be prescribed, you know, across the whole nation. And so participatory budgeting says, let's actually participate in the creation of the city budget or in the town budget. Let's hear the different ideas and projects and draw from those insights in order to create that. And so it's you know, something that is slowly growing as a movement and as an approach to think about applying our principles of democratic decision making to our financial world, our financial outcomes. And so, you know, it's one of those things like the transformative justice in schools where we listen to students. In this case, we listen to members of our town and our community in order to create those ideas and that budget.
Something I didn't necessarily expect to see in a book like this was a discussion of citizen scientists. How are citizen scientists helping contribute to viral justice?
You know, we think about where knowledge comes from in terms of a very narrow arena of higher education, of those who are credentialed with all these letters behind their name, who've got these fancy degrees. But knowledge, there are many different kinds of knowledge. There are disciplinary forms of knowledge, but also there's lived experience. There's knowledge that grows out of one's life and community. And so citizen scientists actually are people who might not have any kind of formal training, but who have particular insights and knowledge, for example, about environmental hazards in their neighborhood. For in Flint, Michigan, for example, one of the reasons why that finally drew national attention is because people who were looking at that dirty water coming out of their sinks when officials were ignoring them actually mobilized and started measuring the level of you know, pollution and lead in that water. And so in similar places, when it comes to, you know, whether it's air quality or whether it is, you know, other kinds of toxins in the environment, there are examples of researchers collaborating with members of the community to collect and to analyze the data because they have a lived experience and insights into that. And that can be a really effective way to get access to data and knowledge that you might not have if you're just sitting in your office at a university.
You do also remind us that trust in science has to be earned by scientists willing to acknowledge the way they have damaged that trust in the past.
So sometimes when we think about trust, we think about different communities who don't have trust in science or medicine, that they're lacking in trust. And so what I'm inviting us to do is to switch the question and to think not about why people lack trust, but why institutions aren't trustworthy. And that changes the responsibility from individuals and communities to these powerful institutions that have breached trust. You know, it really takes an active commitment working in partnership with those who have been harmed historically by these institutions. And I give specific examples, whether it's Johns Hopkins and the I guess lead paint study carried out there by the Kennedy Krieger Institute, or whether it's more historic examples that were more well known, like the US public health study of syphilis in Tuskegee. This is the history and the ongoing ways in which people are harmed. Institutions have to acknowledge that and then actively work to build trust and their own trustworthiness in the process through very tangible ways of repairing that.
How can we identify what you call friends and comrades to work with in pursuit of viral justice?
We all have to kind of look around in our own, what I call plots, and think about like what we care most about, and look around at those who also are really, you know, invested in transforming the everyday oppressive status quo in that context, and working together to do that. This is not lone wolf work. We can't just do it ourselves. It's not just creating an app for change. It's really getting in the trenches with those who care and are passionate about the specific plot that we are, and then building from there and working together.
Ruha Benjamin is professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, where she founded the Ida B. Wells Just Data Lab. Her book is called Viral Justice: How We Grow the World We Want. Ruha, thank you so much for the conversation.
Such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.